So I'm Carsten Leof, and this is about inference in coalescent models. It's more like a theoretical overview. Overview, and maybe with emphasis on inference on demography. So maybe the more popular title is "What Can We Learn About Demography from Genetic Data Demography?" So when I was invited here, I sort of looked at the talks that had been previously, and there was some by Griffiths and there was some by Dick Hodson, and that's many months ago now. But so I sort of, the idea with this talk was to make something in connection with that, but I now realize that many of you were not here that time in the beginning of the program. So in this way, this is maybe a little remote from some of the other things, or at least the other things we've been talking about this week. I might not be able to talk for 2 full hours here because, first of all, I suffer from some jet lag sort of thing, and the other thing is that I've sort of been coughing for a long time, so I don't know how long this will keep going before I have to lie down again. The first thing is that we know that demography and changes in demography, we can see that in genetic variation. So there's sort of a saying that if you have an expanding population, you tend to see more rare variants than in a constant size population. So if we have a population that is sort of fluctuating in size maybe, then the genetic patterns we see in the population tend to be different than, for example, if we just have a constant size population. So it's of course natural to try and use genetic variation, in particular now when we have lots of SNP data and we have DNA sequence data, try to use these to infer something about, for example, human demography. And that can be a complement to what we can learn about human demography from archaeology or other areas or other sciences. So many people have been trying to do that. I mean, take genetic variation data and then try to infer demography from these data. And some recent papers, for example, Adams and Hodgson. I think that was in genetics, and there's also a paper by Bustamende and co-workers. That was in Planck, I think. This one was probably in genetics. But there are many more. That's been a business for many years, probably 10, 15 years now or so. There's another thing, and that is often, and for example in this paper here, people are interested in selection. So saying something about selection at a particular locus in the genome, or maybe selection in general over the whole genome. That's, for example, the case in this paper about Bustamende. But it's also known that the patterns that selection causes in genetic variation often are similar to what can be caused by demography. So there's a point in trying to distinguish what you see, what is caused by demography and what is caused by selection. And in particular, if you want to draw inference about selection, then you might like to extract the background, if you like, the background genetic variation you see that are caused by demography. Okay, so the idea here is actually to give you some theoretical results, and I do that in a very non-technical way. So we might assume here that now I state what I want to show you. So assume we have a model of evolution with demography, and in our case that would be a coalescent model. And I would remind you about what that is in case. I think many of you have sort of a physics background or something. That was my impression from the talks previously. So I'll sort of briefly say what a coalescent model is. Okay, so let's say we have a model of evolution with demography, and this is, we might think of this as a parameterized model. So there's sort of a parameter psi that varies in a space capital psi. And then we can ask different questions, for example. One question would be, what if the true model, let's say that the true model is called, so that's reality in a way. Let's say, what if the true model is actually in our parameter space here? Can we, under some circumstances, estimate, let's say this is an estimator, so this may be a maximum likelihood estimator or something. Would that be converging towards the true one when we collect more and more data? So that can either be as we collect more and more SNPs or longer and longer sequences from the genome or from more and more individuals. So in that case, we would say that we are able to recover the true demography from our data, if this is the case. So this is just a statistical, this is a consistency thing. But of course, maybe more interesting is to say, what if the true model is actually not in our parameter space here? What happens then to the estimator? Can we say something about it? Okay. And this is, of course, a realistic case, because all the models we use here, all the coalescent models people are using, are sort of toy models in some sense. They might mimic certain aspects of reality, but of course they are never the real ones. So this is, of course, an interesting thing to know what happens with such an estimator here. And finally, we could ask, what if we were looking at the frequency spectrum? That might be a third question. The frequency spectrum. And the frequency spectrum, what do I understand by that? Well, let's say we're looking at SNP data. So the frequency spectrum is simply the probability that a SNP are found in I copies in a sample, let's say, of size n. So that would be this one here. Maybe it looks like this. So here can be 1, 2, or 2 n minus. So let's say, what if I looked at the frequency spectrum? Would I then be able to recover the demography? So here I'm sort of not assuming that I have a model. I'm just sort of saying that what if I just look at this frequency spectrum, would there be many different demographies that actually could give rise to this spectrum here? Okay. So all this is about saying what can I actually learn about the demography from looking at genetic variation. And it's a purely statistical sort of thing, and it's not a thing often people often discuss in the literature. So the question is, here, do we have consistency? Do we actually can we actually learn the right model? And here, what happens if the true model is not part of our parameter space? And finally here, would there be many different demographies that could correspond to the same frequency spectrum?
So okay. Is there a precise definition of demography?
No, but there will be one later what I understand by demography here.
Yeah. Yeah, so there is a precise. Yeah. So it's sort of, isn't the answer to that question whether there are many demographies giving rise to a frequency spectrum clear from the outset? Because, you know, I mean, this is a curve to which you can maybe fit four or five parameters if you're lucky, and there are infinitely, the power infinitely many demographies, so.
Yeah, in a way that is, yes. I'm not sure it's completely straightforward that it would be like that, but the answer is yes.
Is defined as a population with a different mean frequency? Or
sorry?
Demography is defined as a subpopulation with a different mean frequency?
I'll define demography in a minute, yeah. Okay, so let's go through some terminology first. Okay, so we have a sample of size n. And we might think of this as some sequences here. We can also think of a number of SNPs, but let's just say sequences. So maybe they have length L. So there are L SNPs or there are L nucleotides. And I might mark mutations on these sequences just by here, saying that these two share mutation, that these two don't share, and so on. I generally assume an infinite size model that is frequently assumed for SNP data. And what is the infinite size model saying? It's saying that all mutations in a given position, you will only see, you will see at most one mutation. So this mutation here has arisen once in the history of the population, and then now the person two individuals. So you don't have any back mutations, you don't have any recurrent mutations, and so on. Okay, and then are you all familiar with the coalescence? So, okay, good. So the standard coalescence or the constant size coalescence? That's the thing that for a sample of size n, we have waiting times wi that are exponentially distributed with parameter I choose 2, such that if I start here with n sequences, then I wait wn until the first coalescence, and that coalescence is between a random pair out of the n choose 2 possible pairs. And then I go on like this. Then the next waiting time here is wn minus 1 and so on, and I construct the genealogy of the sample in this way here. So this one has some nice properties. All these guys are independent, and for example, if I ask for the height of the tree, I mean the time until the most recent common ancestor, that would be the expectation of this one. It's given by this formula here. And what one sees here is that when n becomes large, then this one is bounded. So that means that even if I sample the entire population, then there's a finite time until they have a most recent common ancestor. I can also ask about the length of the genealogy here. That would be this one here. So I simply sum over all the branches here. Down here there are n branches. Here there are n minus 1 and so on. And it the expectation of that one goes like the logarithm of things. So sort of as I build up a bigger sample, then the size of this genealogy only grows like log n. Mutations I add to this genealogy simply by adding mutations according to a Poisson process with parameter, let's call this length, the length of the entire genealogy for Ln. Then we add mutations according to this Poisson process on the generality here. So they are randomly distributed according to a Poisson process here. And theta is the scaled mutation rate, scaled by this. This is the precise mutation rate, and this is the size of the population. Okay, so this is the constant size. And so this is sort of an approximation that you get from many discrete time models of populations when n is large. So this is a very robust approximation, and it's very useful. So let's now we need to introduce what a demography is, and
I think I put these.
And a variable size the correlation with the variable size.
So you won't be looking at selection?
No, this is purely neutral models.
Could you pose that question, how to distinguish selection from demography?
Yeah, I did. Where was that? That was here. And the idea here is that people, for example, in this paper, they're interested in saying something about selection at different sites in the genome. And in order to do that, they want to be able to extract the demography.
And whatever is left is selection.
That's selection, yeah. Of course, you have to figure out how you extract. Okay, so the. So now we consider not a constant size population, but we consider a population that might fluctuate over time. So it has a population size nc. So we start here at present time, and then we go backwards. And the population size, the population size at time t generations in the past is given by nt here. I should also add here that the time in this one here is scaled in units of two n generations. So, and the reason for this is that here I think the population is a diploid one, so there are actually two n genes or two n sequences in the population. So time is scaled here, so if I double this one, then all coalescence times on this in generations would be multiplied by two or so. Okay. Okay. So so now I consider this one here. So now that means that the population might fluctuate in this way here, but it has to do it in a deterministic way. So I know that in advance what this one is. Okay. So for example, popular theories are things that are exponential. Other popular choices are things that, I mean, like bottlenecks, so you consider, maybe I should do that here, if you have a constant size population and then suddenly you decrease the size, and then maybe you expand it again like this. So here the population has gone through a bottleneck, and then, so here, I mean, this is of course in the physical world, very unrealistic. You cannot do like this. You suddenly remove a certain percentage of the population, and then you expand it in an instant again. But as an approximation, it might be good. Okay, so we need to introduce this guy here, which is the size of the population today compared to the size of the population some t ago. Okay, and in order to simulate or describe the coalescence with variable population size, I can do that in terms of the population with constant population size, and then simply do a transform form. So given by this one here. Okay. So what I can do is that at first, let's say I want to simulate a sample of size n. So I simulate under this model here. So I simulate a constant size population. And then I take the time from the constant size population here and transform with this one. So this is the constant size population. And this is the corresponding variable size population. Times in the variable size population. And this is so this is a sort of a local rescaling of time that that varies according to how the population size.
It's an effective population size. Is that what you're calculating?
N here or?
No, the U. It's an effective population size.
Yeah, well, that's a relative population size compared to the to the population size here times zero.
Essentially the harmonic mean.
Yeah, it's the harmonic mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But you can sort of find also like
a time-dependent mutation rate on this transfer. No, you don't have a time-dependent mutation rate. Yeah. So the mutation rate is, where did that, here, so the mutation rate here would be scaled in units of the Corian size here. So that does not change over time. So the mutation rate is the same over time, but the coalescent rate, you would say, would change over time because when the population size decreases, then the chance of coalescence would be bigger, and when it increases, it would be smaller. So that is what is going on here. Okay, so I can describe, any demography like this in terms of the constant size population. Okay, so this is the strict definition of a demography. Yeah, so I already gave you some examples. Where did they go? There's like this one and the exponential case. And these are probably the most popular. This is widely believed for the human one, so they've been going through a bottleneck not that many thousand years ago. But sometimes, for example, in the Bustamante paper, they use a model that just do like this. Whereas in other papers, they would use a model like this. So this one has an additional parameter because you have a second time frame. And this one is, of course, a reasonable model for more modern human expansion, maybe over the last 10,000 years or so. So where did I go here? Okay, so let's see what we can actually say about inference in these cases. I need to erase some of what I put here. I wonder if that's not the right. Which might be the right one.
So by demography you mean population size?
Yes. Some of this can actually be extended to include migration or other things like that. But for here we just keep it simple and think about one population that sort of varies in size over time in a deterministic way. Some of this might actually also be done in a stochastic way, but that's more problematic. But just to get an idea about what we might expect for inference on. So in principle, what we want to draw inference about is this guy here. Okay, so we observe some genetic variation in the population, and then what we want to learn about is this one here. We want to learn about how does this relative thing change over time. And we might think of this either, in terms of these questions, I mean, one could say, okay, what can I, the first one was to say, okay, what is the true one? Is part of my parameter space, so that could be I was only considering populations that are exponentially expanding over time. So the question would here be, if the true, so maybe I should call that at least a north now here. So what if the true one is actually part of my parameter space? Can I find an estimator that actually give me the right one as a collect more and more data? And for the second question here, that would be, say, what if the true one was actually not part of it? What happens then with whatever estimate I have here? And the last question, question three, might be phrased in this way as, if I look at the frequency spectrum, this is sort of a unique correspondence to a demography here.
For your model, do you assume no recombination or?
For now, I assume no recombination, but of course, when I want to look at more and more sites, I need to include recombination. But for this description here, we just assume no recombination. Okay. And it, of course, it's obvious that since the time here until even an infinitely large sample has a common ancestor is finite, then I should not expect to learn too much about the very distant part of the demography. Okay, but before I get to inference on these guys here, let me just recapitulate a few things about the mutation rate, inference about that, and that's a lot of well-known things. So we were assuming that mutations were occurring like the Poisson. So let's say Sn is the number of mutations in a sample of size n. That means that the expected number is given by this. It's just from this Poisson thing. And that means, because this is ln, the expectation here is approximately the logarithm, then I see that the number of mutations is sort of increasing like the logarithm of the sample size. So the number of mutations is sort of not really increasing. I mean, if I double my population size, then I don't really get a lot of raw information if I think of mutations as information. Okay. There are now two situations I could consider. So let's say I have this sample here. I could now consider a situation where I extend my sequences further, like this. I could also consider a situation where I was just sampling more and more sequences. Okay. And what I'm now interested in is just to say, what can I learn about the mutation rate from the number of mutations in these two situations, and I just want to use that as a background for inference on the demography. Okay, so there are two frequently used estimators for the mutation rate. One is derived from this by substituting the observed number for the expected number here, and then rearranging. So what I get here, what is that I get? Like this. So this one is called Watterson's estimator, and it's from 1975. And the other one is the Gemmell's estimator, and I think it's from 98. And here we have to remember that that our mutation rate, we calculate that per site, because we sort of want to be able to take into account that we include more and more sites. So here we have a L that indicates the number of sites. And Tajima's estimator in this case would look like this, where N is sample size again, and where we sum over on these guys here, where the PIJs are pairwise differences between sequence I and J. So in this case, that would be 2, because this one has one mutation, the other one doesn't have, and likewise this one here, so that would be 2. And these two here are identical, so PIJ would be 0 in that case.
I've lost your notation. Can you just say again what the notation is in those two? Remind us what all the symbols are, because I've got a bit lost.
Okay, so this is the number of mutations. So in this case here, if I just look at this sample here, that would be 1, 2, 3.
In a finite length sequence.
Yes, in a sequence of length L. And this is the expected length of the linearity. So in the constant size coalescence, that would be this guy here, that is roughly 2 times the logarithm of N.
That's in units of N. That's in, because early on you said that there's a finite time to the coalescence as N goes up, but that's because you've divided by N, you've scaled by N already. It's not.
No, there's a difference here, because this is little n. And little n is a sample I take from the entire population of that has size capital N. So I scale time in capital N.
Yes.
And not in little n.
Okay, so the time is finite proportional to big N, but it doesn't change as little n increases, it doesn't change.
Yeah.
So when you say number of mutations, you mean what is generally referred to as set number of segregating sites, is that?
Yeah.
Okay. Right, so this Sn is this. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So these guys here, at least they have surprise properties. So they have the right expectations. And we can also calculate the variance. Maybe I should put them somewhere else. Maybe you want to put them here.
Could you define pi ij as well?
Sorry? Yeah, that's a pairwise difference between sequences. So pi ij is in this case is 2, and pi ij for these two is 0. So this is a sum over n choose 2 pairs.
This is a different thing than this Tajima's D, right?
Yes.
Would that be a difference between that then?
Yeah, so Tajima's D, so this is an estimator of the mutation rate. This guy here, Tajima's
right,
estimator.
Tajima's D is
roughly the difference between these two estimators, right, and then divided by some normalizing thing here. And the idea is that these two guys uses the information in the data in different ways.
Uh-huh.
Because when you do, I mean here, each mutation count only once.
Yeah.
Over here, some mutations count more often than other ones.
Understand, yeah, okay.
So a singleton would count differently than something that occurs in two sequences.
But it's both estimators for 4 and U.
Yes, and the idea here is that in the constant size world, you would expect this one to be approximately 0,
yeah,
because this should give you the same.
And then you have positive selection.
But if you have selection or sort of demographic changes, then you might get deviation from 0 here. Okay, so let's see. We can give an approximate. There's an exact formula, but we just need the approximate formula for the variance of Watterson's estimator. And here K is just a constant. And this is in the absence of recombination. Whereas for Tejimas, it's easier to do calculations with Tejimas. So here we have a more general expression that looks like this. Where I need to add something here. And here there's a logarithm. And where this little row here also is a scaled recombination rate per site. So this is a recombination rate per site. Just like the mutation rate is a mutation rate per site. Okay, so here I now get an idea about the variance as a function of the sample size n and as the length of the sequences. Okay, and if these guys are good estimators, then the variance should go to zero as I either get more and more sequences or I get longer and longer sequences. And we can ask whether that is the case. Well, in this case here, we see that when n goes to infinity, then this one goes to zero, this one and also this one, but it goes at the rate of 1 over log n. So this is very slow. I mean, of course, that is comparable to the increase of mutations in the sample. So this goes very slowly. So if you compare to what you see when you sample things independently, where you typically have a factor n here, then this is very slow. If you don't have recombination, you see that you are not able to go accurate inference about the mutation rate because this term here disappears, but this one does not disappear. And this is, of course, just saying that if you don't have recombination, then these guys here, when you get longer and longer sequences, all sites here share the same history. And this term is sort of just saying that there's a stochastic element in the genealogy, and we don't know that element. So we would not be able to get accurate information about the mutation rate. But if we look at this one here, that actually is valid also for in the case of with recombination, I see that as when the sequence length goes to infinity, L here, then this term here disappears. And this one goes to zero, log L rho over L rho. Okay, so that is basically log L divided by L. Okay, so that's sort of giving you the correlation between sites as you increase the sequence. Okay, so again, if you compare to a situation where all sites were independent, then this would be 1 over L, and here it's log L divided by L. So it goes slower, but it still goes faster than this one here. Okay, so in a way, this might be what we expect. At least that was what people were expecting for other parameters as well. And that could, for example, be demographic parameters, it could be migration rates, it could be recombination rates, it could be gene conversion rates, and so on. People were expecting that this should be the rule, that when you get more and more sequences, your estimators would converge like this. So eventually, in the end, you would be able to recover the true parameter. And when you get longer and longer with recombination, then a convergence should go like this. Okay, so let's see to what extent this holds true when we look at these demographic things over here.
So what about the convergence with little n? Because is that an n plus 1 or an n minus 1 there?
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whereas the other one is going to converge with
yeah.
n.
Yeah, I actually want these two expressions because I want to use one of them for n and the other one for l. Because this one I don't know for in the case of recombination. So I need this one to handle the recombination case. Because if I increase n here, then I'm actually in a situation where this one goes to a constant, a non-zero constant, and the same for this one here. No, this one disappears. So this one does not. So this one has a problem that I don't recover the true mutation rate as sample size become large. So I actually want to use this one for n and this one for l. So that was just to make the point that sort of I get more information by sampling this way than by sampling this way, and that's an observation made by Donnelly and Klusnikov in 1994. Maybe it's Klusnikov and Donnelly, that you sort of gain more from sampling longer sequences than more sequences. But of course, I mean, if you're interested in mutation rate, then maybe you're not interested in sampling longer. I mean, it could be changing. But I mean, as a mean of illustration. Okay, sorry. Okay. Okay, so what I want to do now, next, we want to look at the variable population size case. Okay, so now we have some function here that describes the demographic changes over time. And I'm interested in the two situations. What can I say as I get more and more sequences? And what can I say as I get longer and longer sequences? And here I would, of course, need to assume some form of recombination, because we saw here that without recombination it's not going to work out. Okay, so let's consider this situation first. So what we have ideally is a sample of size n, and then we want to increase the sample to make it bigger and bigger. Instead of maybe we should have a break now, just so that I can finish. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Situation was that now we are looking at a variable population size case, and we want to know whether we can infer anything about the relative population size here, and as n increases towards infinity. And instead of assuming I observe sequences, I would make my problem easier and assume that I actually observe the entire tree. Okay, of course I never able to do that, because that would mean I should have walked along the ancestors here and sort of said, okay, there was a mate and here was one and so on. But that is just to make my problem simpler. I assume that I form the tree, and then as n increases, that means that I get more and more branches on the tree. Okay, so observation is tree. Okay, I need one regularity condition in order to get this to work out, and that is that when I'm close to present time, that is close to time zero, then this relative population size can be written like this, where A is some constant, and then this is just some term that vanishes for small t. And this is sort of a natural requirement. This is an A. For example, in the case where I have an expanding population, I mean, this is just saying that one plus B to C plus something else. And if you look into the literature, I mean, all kind of models people are using fulfill this requirement. I mean, this one, for example, in particular, because it's just constant near time zero. So it's just preventing the population near zero from doing something very bizarre. I mean, you could this would probably not correspond to anything remotely realistic, but you could have a situation like this, for example. This one would not fulfill this one because, yeah. So for here, I know this one here, so that means I also know this one. So this is, and so what would this would sort of correspond to, that the population would do something very weird just in a second before present time. So this is a reasonable regularity assumption, and under that assumption one is able to prove that if I look at the density. So now now let's say I have Tn refers to the waiting times in the variable size coalescence. So let's say now I erased it from here, but I had in the constant size coalescence I had these waiting times here, and I would have similar ones. Let's call them this. In a variable size. Then I can consider the density of this guy here relative to the density of the constant size coalescent. And then one can prove, it's sort of not a difficult proof, but it's sort of just a lot of bookkeeping things, where you need this regularity thing. That even in the situation where you sample the entire population, an infinitely large population, this one is bounded away from infinity and it's bounded away from zero. And what does that mean in statistical terms? It means that if I want to compare the hypothesis that an observed tree, now this T here is referring to a tree, if I want to compare the hypothesis that an observed tree is from this variable size population to the situation where it's from the constant size population, then their relative likelihoods does not go to infinity or does not go to zero. So that means they're not one of them that's sort of giving incredible evidence. I mean, if this one was going to infinity, I would get a lot of evidence in favor of this guy here, and otherwise if it was going to zero, I would get a lot of evidence in favor of this guy. So this is the proof that I'm unable, even in a situation where I sample infinitely many individuals in my population, I'm unable to distinguish with 100% accuracy between these two scenarios here. So what is the consequence here? The consequence is here that I cannot have the power to distinguish variable size from constant size. It's not one for even a very large sample.
Yes. Isn't this somewhat the case also that it's also as n goes to infinity and as l goes to infinity, because
You say that the tree, the observation is the tree, so you know the tree. And that's, you know the tree if you have an infinite number of mutations.
Yeah. Also, yeah, that's true. I mean, I could say I know the tree if I had an infinite number of mutations, but I'm sort of here just assuming that, I mean, I'm looking at a single loci or so, and logs, and then, so this is an ideal situation. So I'm sort of not concerned with L infinity, but it's true. In order to know the tree, I would probably like to have L infinity, but L infinity without recombination.
Right.
Because otherwise I get into trouble. Okay, so this is saying that I would never, from a single locus, be able to tell exactly what demography I have. Maybe that's not really surprising, I guess. I think people were expecting this one to hold true. But, I mean, statistically you would say that the effective size of effective sample size is one. I mean, because even when you sample more and more, your information sort of does not increase very much. But when you think about it, it might be quite natural. So this is a constant size, and then the variable size fulfilling this, so it's sort of, I think that might go like this. And as we sample more and more sequences in the tree, then we sample a lot of them that are close to zero, because we know that the waiting times here, there, in the constant size, they are exponential n choose 2. And because of this assumption here, you get a similar thing here. You don't get exactly n choose 2, but you get something that is very close to n choose 2. So it means that as you increase your sample size or the size of your tree, what you learn about is actually in the very recent past, and you don't learn about what you actually want to know about the more distant past. Yeah. Of course, it would be difficult to know about what is going on very far back here, because that would extend beyond the most recent common ancestor, for example. So this is just saying that you don't really gain anything from sampling more and more sequences. And that is, I mean, that you of course can formulate like, so if you had a maximum likelihood estimator for, based on a sample of size n, for example, in this case here, that's a very popular case, that would just say that this one is not consistent. So even if you sample more and more, you would never get that close to the true one, or not necessarily close to the true one.
So that rate, I mean, there's a lot of difference between north and infinity, right? So how big or small does that ratio get in practice?
Yeah, that's another question, because, that of course, that depends on this one here. No, on beta, in the case. I mean, how different this one is from constant size.
Yeah, but that's a kind of a mathematical way of looking at it.
Yes.
But I mean, in practice, maybe you can, I mean, if that varies from 0.01 to 100 or something, then you're pretty happy.
Yeah. Actually, this is more a theoretical thing than maybe a practical thing, because I mean, you could, for example, ask what is the power to, for example, based on this exponential expanding population size case, you could ask what is the power to distinguish beta from zero. Okay, so that is to say we have a hypothesis here, beta bigger than zero versus one saying that beta is zero. And I mean, if we assume that we observe the tree, then you see that the power to tell that it's not zero is actually quite high in many cases. Here, even for small values of beta, you get things like here, sample size n, if it's 10, 20, 100, here you get it's fairly low, maybe, but already here, it's much bigger, and here it's 99. I mean, so if your objective is to just distinguish between the constant size case and an expanding case, then you might have very good power.
So that's the fraction of samples for which there would be a significant difference, is that right?
Yes. So you draw a sample of size 20 with beta 5, and then you ask whether it's more likely that it's from the constant size than from the beta 5 case. So in practice, this thing here, of course, this is based on observing the tree, so these numbers here would be much smaller if you were basing that on sequence data. Because from sequence data, I would not know the exact tree.
These numbers can be estimated how?
I just did that by simulation. So we are getting closer to an end. And the question is whether I can find the paper right here. So maybe that is not so surprising. Of course, people have been using single locus data to try to estimate the demographic parameters. But when you look into the literature, of course, people would say you should use data from all over the genome. So let's look at that situation here. Now let's look at the situation. So again, we are looking at a variable size. And now we are assuming that our sequences or number of SNPs or whatever are getting longer and longer. Okay. So ideally, one should calculate then the probability of the data for a given parameter. Let's assume this one might be parameterized by some parameter. But as these sequences become longer and longer, and now n is fixed, I mean, to the sample sizes. As these sequences become longer and longer, this is a more and more intractable thing to calculate. So now we have recombination between sequences as well. So what people are doing instead is that they say, okay, let's look at a composite likelihood function. So CL for composite likelihood, that takes the form here, where you simply divide your data into k parts. So in this case, that would say, let's say you have the sequences here. Then you might divide them into k equal parts here, 1, 2, k. Okay? And then you calculate the probability of the data for each part here, and then you assume they're independent, so you just multiply them together. And the question is, of course, what if you base inference on this guy here? on CL, what happens here? So here we are assuming things are independent, which they are not. And what people typically do here is that, there are some approaches where you look at a little sequence here, for example, Donnelly and, that would be Fernhead. And Donnelly has one approach where they do this and where they chop up sequences into parts. But there are more popular things. That's, for example, in this Adams and Watson, where each part here is one SNP. So k is actually the number of SNPs. And then the idea is that you simply just calculate the probability of serving that SNP, four SNPs. So that's a very easy thing to do. Okay, so instead of looking at this guy here, you might look at the logarithm of this one here. So and say let's take the average also. So that would just say that that's the one that corresponds to the log likelihood. So that would be the log composite. Okay, so this would be the one you would base your inference on. So you would maximize this one for, I mean, given your data, you would maximize this one for psi, and psi would now be some demographic parameters. This scheme here actually works for in much more general setting, not just for the demographic thing. It also works for if you want to include migration or gene conversion and many different things you. Okay, so the idea is that you maximize this LK, and then we ask, what can we say about that estimator? We get this one, so we call it psi hat. What can we say about that estimator? And actually, there are some regularity conditions in order to get things like this to work. So one thing one needs to assume is that the model you have here, and here, and here, and here, are the same. So you sort of have a stationarity requirement. So if you push everything one, then you have the same model. So that makes it, for example, difficult to include selection in this, because you might want like sort of have selection to be more specific to the genomic region. But so you need to assume some stationarity. But that seems a fairly mild requirement, actually. And then one thing you need to prove is that this guy here, this is actually based on some fairly heavy mathematical work by a guy called Pesch here. And the idea is to look up this work and then just transform it into this setting here and then extract all the results from that. So the idea is that you need to be able to show that this guy here, that it converts to the expected value under the true model. Okay, and the true model might now be something that is actually in our parameter space, or maybe it's something that is outside the parameter space. If you're able to prove this, then it follows that this guy here, the maximum composite estimator, is a consistent estimator. That is this guy here. The estimator is converging towards the true one, in case the true one is in the model, and it's converging towards something else in case the true one is not in the model. But how you are to interpret this is difficult. But this is, of course, relevant because we never have the true model included in the true parameter here included in our model. Reality is always different from an exponential size thing or whatever. But this is saying that eventually, I mean, if you double the number of SNPs you put into this, then you just get something that is even closer to whatever parameter here it is. But how you are to interpret it afterwards is, of course, a problem. And that, for example, if you look into this paper by Bustamendi here, where they used a model like this, and they use this one first in order to extract the demography and then be able to say something about selection afterwards. And they don't at all go into details about, I mean, what should I think about this sort of weird demographic scenario, which you sort of know is not true. But they sort of know that it's at least we're in a situation where things are converging to something. But how you are to interpret it afterwards is of course a problematic thing. So in order to prove that this guy here is converging towards this one, one needs to look at this one here. And if you simply calculate the variance here, then you would like to know that the variance was going to zero as the number of chunks here is getting big. You get more and more things. And if that was, if they were all independent, then of course that was a straightforward thing to do. But in our case, they are not independent because they're a recombination between them. So the dependence is sort of dying out as you move further away. But for those close by, you still have a lot of dependencies. So the question is, how fast is this dying out? And the whole exercise here is actually to prove that this one is converging at a reasonable rate. And it actually turns out that this guy here, this one here is converging I mean, if we say k is the number of chunks or SNPs or whatever, then it's converging at this rate here, just like the rate I had down here for the genus estimator in the beginning. So this is saying that convergence is happening, and I actually get the correctest, the true one out of it eventually if it's in my parameter space, and this one is converging in this way. So this is suggesting, it's not proving, because this is a convergence of this one. So this is suggesting that this guy here is also converging at rate.
Yes. Suggesting.
And how does the prefactor depend on the recombination rate?
Sorry?
How does the prefactor depend on the recombination rate?
If the precise recombination rate is zero, then it actually depends like this. So if you have high recombination rate, then convergence is much faster than that. And of course, that's intuitively okay. Okay, so that was actually tick. So I can just spend 5 minutes on this one here, unless there's some questions to the other parts.
Can I ask a bit more about how big beta is for humans? I mean, what does beta is like? That table says if beta is big, it works, right?
So this is a value you often see in the literature. People would say that beta is 1,000 for, I mean, for the European population. Or so we are this guy here is also this is per generation growth rate, and this is effective population size.
The effective population size at the end. It's the end of naught.
Yes. Yeah, so that's the present day here.
Which is still, so the other question is, what does end of naught mean? Because end of naught is still very much smaller than the real population size.
Yeah, I mean, that's a question. Yeah. I mean, that's a very difficult question. I mean, I actually don't know any good answers to what is this in really? I mean, you see so many different, I mean, for the constant size, people would often say n is, 10,000 or so for humans. But what you really mean by it, sort of the idea is that it should reflect a right Fisher model or so in certain ways. I guess this one should have a similar interpretation, but I think it's better just to leave it. No, so let me tell you.
It's coming out of the coalescent, right?
Sorry?
This number is taken out. You do coalescent with fixed population sizes, that's the number you get.
This one here?
Yeah.
This is the number people get from looking at data and.
So all of those estimates, Tajima and all the other things, right?
Yeah, actually, I think it's a bit circular how you get these. I mean, sort of you give one argument in favor of this one, and then later you use this one to argue for the thing you deducted from, and so on. So let me spend 5 minutes on the last one here. And it's only going to be 5 minutes, and it's just because it's sort of a funny thing, I think. And it's something I found in a paper by Myers. I think Myers was here last week. Yeah. Myers and someone I forgot, and then Patterson. That's not very nice that I forgot. But the idea is that, okay, let's say now we know the frequency spectrum. And we might know, at least get a good approximation of for this from looking at a lot of SNP data. Okay, so sort of have a frequency spectrum here. And if we look at theoretical models in the Wright-Fishy model or in the constant, similar in the standard coalescent, constant size coalescent, then the frequency spectrum is sort of proportional to this. So the probability to find a mutant in frequency y is given by this one. And of course, you cannot integrate this one from zero because it doesn't make sense. So here we have a population of, I mean, the mutant must be in frequency 1 over 2n, that is the population size, up to whatever here. So there's a normalizing constant that depends on this n here. Okay. So the question is sort of, if we know the frequency spectrum, how much do we know about the about this guy in the market. And these guys, Myers and Patterson, they go through a lot of fairly mathematical details. And then they found out that that what they are looking for is, okay, let's say we now have one, we have a frequency spectrum that corresponds to this guy here. Then what they can show is that if they have a function, f of t here, that that fulfills this requirement here for all i bigger than 0.
What's the exponential?
Sorry?
What's the exponential?
Yes, e to the minus I plus 1 times I plus 2. Now here, I is allowed to be 0 also. Okay, if you have a function that fulfills this for all I, then, okay, so this one is equally given by this guy here. Then this demography has the same frequency spectrum, and here alpha is a constant. And maybe it's not surprising from what you're saying or so, but it's still, I mean, they point to one function, which is a quite interesting or funny function. Did I draw it here? Yes, I did. So it has to be positive, because otherwise we risk that this one goes below zero. So they point to one that sort of looks like this. I mean, they can prove that it, and it goes to one here. Okay. And that's sort of an interesting thing. They're saying that this one here, if this one is, if they start out with the constant size case, and then they add this guy here where it's this one, then this one has the same frequency spectrum as the constant size case. And this one, what does this one look like? I mean, this one is roughly like a constant for, this is, I don't remember, this is maybe one back in time, it's not that far back in time. So this is saying that in the recent past, it's constant like, it's roughly constant, but then it has a bottleneck, a very severe bottleneck here. And then it comes up again. And in that case, that bottleneck, you would sort of mistake that for a constant size population.
Sorry, this F, I mean, is it, this is the only requirement that it has to be, that this interval has to vanish for all I?
Yeah.
I mean, that.
And then it has to be positive.
No, but it's possible. It cannot be positive.
It is possible. It's possible for this guy here.
Function, yeah.
Positive function times a positive function.
Exactly.
It cannot be.
This is weird somehow.
No. Maybe this is a false requirement. This guy, of course, has to be positive. Yeah.
But I mean.
Yeah.
This is a pretty. Can that be fulfilled by a whole? By a lot of functions. I mean.
They only give this one solution here. But I guess one can probably they use what is that? I forgot what that theorem is called. But I guess the math stuff they're using might be used to get other examples.
But that doesn't satisfy the condition. That F doesn't satisfy the condition because it's positive.
Yeah. No. So this should be zero here. Yeah.
I'm a little bit surprised that this sort of null mode F is independent on the original N. Because intuitively, so what this variable computation does, it's a variable rate by which you feed in a low frequency polymorphism, then they propagate somehow. And now, so they those guys found one sort of modification of this feeding in, so that sort of the overall profile is the same, if I understand that correctly. So then why is this FFT not dependent on the shape on which you start? That sounds a bit surprising to me.
So why is what not dependent?
Why can this function which keeps the spectrum the same does not depend on sort of the
the original demography,
or the shape of the spectrum. So are these guys saying, so take any frequency spectrum and add this to the demography and you get the same?
Yeah.
So it's not 1 over y, it could be any frequency spectrum, or?
Yeah, it's not necessarily the constant one, no. I can send you the reference. It's based on some mainly some diffusion theory and then some other stuff.
A is arbitrary or it's related to N?
Sorry?
A, the constant A.
A is free. You just need the requirement that this one stays positive. But that was it.